A huge spaceship up to 1 kilometer long could be built by China, as the country's space agency is working on a plan for the build. The National Natural Science Foundation revealed a 4-year program is in place to try and work out if they could build such a large ship in orbit. This would require sending components up to space on rockets and somehow assembling the spaceship in zero gravity conditions. China's foundation said it was looking at space equipment for future exploration. It was the goal of having a long-term stay in orbit. If the 1 kilometer spaceship was built, that would make it 10 times bigger than the International Space Station. China's state media has revealed the plans are complicated. I'd guess so. You can read more of that in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Just a reminder, tonight on Coast to Coast, Sunday, August 29th into Monday morning, in the first half, in the fall of 1966, Eduardo Turrella, confidant of billionaire Doris Duke, informed the possessive and vindictive heiress that he was leaving her employ as chief designer and art curator. Minutes later, she crushed him to death under the wheels of a 2-ton station wagon as they were leaving Rough Point, her Bellevue Avenue estate in Newport, Rhode Island, the storied resort. Investigative journalist Peter Lance joins guest host Ian Punnett to discuss this allegedly murderous incident, along with Bob Walker, who was a 13-year-old paperboy when he witnessed the crime. In the second half, Jack the Ripper, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, and Lacusta of Gaul. Now, if that last name doesn't seem to fit with the others, it's likely because our modern society largely believes that serial killers are a recent phenomenon. Not so, argues Debbie Felton, professor of classics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She'll share with Ian the ample evidence to show that serial killers stalk the ancient world just as they do the modern one. Wow, fascinating. I can't wait for that one. That's Ian Punnett tonight, Sunday into Monday morning on Coast to Coast AM. Back with more of my conversation with Don Dondary, PhD, the author of Truth, Lies, and ETs. More of that coming up on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Don Dondary, PhD, stays with us. Previously, the author of UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions, the new one again, Truth, Lies, and ETs. A favorite quote of mine, Don, from the late Soviet dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He said, "We know they're lying. They know they're lying. They know we know they're lying. We know they know we know they're lying, but they're still lying." When it comes to the UFO ET issue, what is lying at the heart of the lie? Why are they lying? What are they trying to protect us from or keep us from?
Well, that started a long time ago. It's a very funny quote. I write about this in a section of the book called Lies, and basically what it starts with is immediately after the so-called Kenneth Arnold incident in 1947, when for the first time, not the first time, but the first widely publicized time, a private pilot saw what were then just called flying saucers flying near his airplane over the Cascade Mountains in the state of Washington. A week or so later, a flying saucer, quote-unquote, crashed near Roswell, New Mexico, and the pieces were swept up by the U.S. Air Force, and immediately the lie came in, because the government covered up that story by saying a weather balloon had crashed. The people who had originally reported the story were basically told to recant what they said, and if they were government employees, they did. The guy who found it was told to shut up, and he did. And from then on, from basically the beginning of the modern UFO era, although there were a couple of sightings in the end of the Second World War before that, the U.S. government carried out an active disinformation campaign, which ended basically with the publication of those documents in December 16th, 2017, the UFOs seen by the U.S. Navy pilots. So for a long time, the U.S. government's official position was nothing happened. It was actually said as much. The U.S. Air Force had a website posting which said nothing reported as UFOs has ever been found to be of extraterrestrial origin, so forth and so on. That ended without comment, and the government doesn't say that anymore. But the lie, you might call it the big lie, lasted for a long, long time. and only stopped 5 years ago.
And now the truth, I suppose, is coming out in dribs and drabs. Does that indicate to you perhaps that there is some titanic struggle going on backstage between those that want to reveal the truth and those that want to maintain a lie?
I don't know. And I have to be honest about that, because if I try and make a fool of myself by telling you more than I have any possible way of knowing, I'll just become one of those discredited people, and people will use cognitive dissonance not to pay attention to what I'm saying. So here's a possibility. The people who we think are on the good side now, those are the people who have contributed to getting this information out. People like Luis Elizondo, who's the Pentagon employee who's gone public on this. Christopher Mellon, the Department of Defense undersecretary who went public. The pilots, David Fravor, Alex Dietrich, who have talked about this, are all people who are telling us what they know. They don't know that much. If there are people who know more, I don't know. But put it as plainly as that. The lies cover-up, so to speak, is not unknown. I wrote a section of the book about it. The people who were active in it were U.S. government employees. They're on the record for having quoted this stuff in CIA reports, and likewise, they were civilians opted into it. People like Philip Klass and Donald Menzel, both respected people in the aerospace trade, Donald Menzel being a professor, Edward Condon being the chairman of the committee that was investigating UFOs back in the 60s, all of those people were complete deniers. Some of them were working under what you might call CIA orders, and that's understood and it's published. That's not questionable. Whether there was anybody else who knew more about that than the deniers knew, I don't know. If I had to guess, I'd say yes, because with something as obvious, although it took years to find out about this in detail, people like Kevin Randall, Don Schmidt, who are UFO investigators, dug very deeply to find this out. If there was that much that had happened at Roswell, and it was so immediately covered up, it stands to reason, not to evidence, that some other group was paying attention to it because it was so important. But that is all I can say, and that's all I know.
Can you...
very unsatisfying, I know.
No, well, yeah. Ultimately, it is. The whole field is, you know, there's never any resolution. But ultimately, though, do you have any ideas as to what is lying at the heart of this lie? Are they trying to prevent panic? Are they trying to keep us from suppressed technology? Are they just simply fearful because there's nothing that can be done about this?
Well, first of all, if I were in the government and had been in the government in 1947, I would immediately want to start learning how, if possible, to reverse engineer the machines that this one of which crashed and the others of which were basically surveilling the Earth at that time. And it would be obviously in the interest of any government to possess a technology that enabled them to do what ETVs routinely do. So there's an obvious motivation for carrying out that kind of study. Who is carrying out, where it's being carried out, if it's being carried out, I have no knowledge whatsoever. And none of the rest of us do either.
Let's go to the phones. Don, we're going to start on the wild card line, and Doc is in Petaluma, California. Hey, Doc, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm doing pretty good. Now, everybody's familiar with the hybridization program. What in your estimation, Professor, do you think that the aliens are benevolent toward us, or you think they're trying to help us? I know they've stopped nuclear, you know, disarmed nuclear weapons and such in the past. But, I mean, do they have our good intentions, you know, toward us, or are they evil incarnate, you know?
Well, there may be more than one species of alien from more than one place. And so the answer is maybe mixed, and I don't know. Again, I'm trying to be very clear about what I do know or what I purport to know and what I haven't a clue about. And the answer is I haven't a clue about that. It worries me. Obviously, there's a chapter in my book called The E.T. Challenge, and I think we have to be able to deal with E.T.s from wherever they are with an equivalent technology, which we might or may not be developing, and with some means of defense against telepathic control. And I think both of those things are priorities. Both of them would put us in a better position to deal with ETs as more equal than we are now.
Doc, thanks for the call. Something has always perplexed me. Having spoken to, I don't know, maybe 100 abductees over the years doing radio programs like this, and that is despite the horror that they're subjected to, and in some cases, experimentation, poking, prodding, obviously a great deal of emotional distress. When they come out the other side, there is almost a transcendence, an acceptance, and almost a positive view of what they've gone through. Is that Stockholm syndrome? Are they, what do you think is happening there? Why do they have this transcendent feeling after they've been used and abused in such a horrible way?
Well, first of all, I think you've probably talked to more abductees than I have. But second, I think you're right, based on what I know. I work with groups of people who work with abductees, although very seldom do I work with one or more myself. The answer is they may be under persuasion, so to speak. And again, you're absolutely right that a lot of people who report abduction experiences do not report them negatively. They either gain from them in some practical way, or they've been persuaded that they do, or they've been cured of some ailment, and that modifies their opinion. There are a variety of reasons, the main one of which is if you can be persuaded to believe anything telepathically, the one thing you may be able to be persuaded is that this is good for you. So the control makes the outcome credible, put it that way.
Let's say hi to Diego on the first-time caller line in Berkeley, California. Diego, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was hoping, Don, that you can describe to us an abduction case you find extremely credible, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know that many abduction cases that well. I know the Barney and Betty Hill case very well, partly because I know not a participant, but a relative, and who's also involved in the UFO and abduction field. I know a couple of cases that I've talked to Bud Hopkins about, abduction cases with the hybrids as well. I've met an abductee. The case I know best is the one that was reported by Bud Hopkins in a book called Witnessed, and the abductee is called in the book Linda Cortelli. She is a first-generation Italian, grew up in New York, was abducted out of the window of her apartment very publicly in 1996. And the abduction was actually seen by witnesses, independent witnesses. She experienced it, in part, remembered part of it, remembered the rest under hypnosis. I actually attended one of the hypnosis sessions of Linda's that's described in Bud's book. And so I'd say that's the case I understand best and know best. And it didn't leave her totally traumatized. She's a normal, quote-unquote, human being, still carrying on, as far as I know, a normal life. I last saw her in the 90s. But that's the case I know best, and it's attested by other witnesses as well as by the abductee herself.
You mentioned that you'd met a hybrid. Anything stand out about this individual that... I mean, that this individual would be revealed as a hybrid? Any physical characteristics? Or do they blend in?
I did something that when you do it in public, you have to excuse yourself for. I misspoke myself. I met a guy, one of David Jacobs' abductees, who worked with hybrids. I should have said that. I made a mistake. The abductee is a perfectly normal human being. In fact, he's... But he's not a hybrid. I have never met a person who I suspected of being a hybrid. I apologize to all the listeners who've tuned out now and who might have heard me say the wrong thing. I meant to say the guy who's called Sean Allen in David's book has worked with abductees. The work was interesting, but he isn't an abductee himself, and I never met one. Sorry.
A hybrid, you mean?
No, he's not a hybrid. Right.
Right. Got it. Okay. Carol is in Tennessee. Carol, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hi. Actually, in Tallahassee, which is home to the planet's largest high magnetic lab, only 3 miles away from me. Several years ago, I was on a private tour and noticed that the U.S. Navy has had a project cooperating with the magnetics lab. There were no questions that were answered about that project. And, of course, even a few years ago, I was very interested in that and very curious. I wondered if you had any comments about that or if you knew about that. And a separate comment is that I have a close friend who is very fearful and thinks that she and her father were both abducted by aliens, and I have not been able to, she's very fearful about that, and I haven't been able to access any information about that.
Well, you might put her in contact with MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, because they have a network of people, including some in Florida, who deal with abductees, and they're trained to do that. They're therapists or they're people who've had experience with abductees who talk to them and allow them to discuss in public, which is a good, and or to other people, which is a large part of what therapy is, their experiences and share them. So I suggest those people, or in you on their behalf, contact the organization called the Mutual UFO Network. It's easy to find on the Internet. Secondly, there's a U.S. Navy patent I mentioned earlier for an electromagnetic flying device, and it's held by a man named Alexander Pais, P-A-I-S. It's a public patent. Anyone can look it up, and it's held. Pais is a government employee, a U.S. Navy government employee, and it's held by the Navy. His name is on it, and it purports to be a electromagnetic anti-gravity machine. So there you go.
All right, Carol, thank you for that. Let's see. Do we have time? I don't think we have time for another call before the break at the bottom of the hour here. I do want to talk about the ET challenge that you mentioned. And we've just got about a minute here before we step away.
Okay.
But that ET, we can begin the conversation, I suppose, now. We'll hold off. We'll talk about that. What exactly is this ET challenge against human civilization? I'm guessing it has something to do with their, you know, superiority in terms of technology and perhaps their motives. We'll get into that as well. Don Dondarry, PhD, the author of UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions, and his latest, Truth Lies and ETs, How We Stumbled Into the Galaxy, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Scientists searching for life-bearing exoplanets have identified a new class of potentially habitable world. To date, the search for habitable extrasolar worlds has focused mainly on the search for rocky terrestrial worlds with temperatures and atmospheric conditions similar to our own. When it comes to finding life, however, we may need to think a little more outside the box. Now, according to a team of astronomers from Cambridge University's Institute of Astronomy, so-called Hycean exoplanets, which have surfaces covered in water and atmospheres rich in hydrogen, could be the ideal place to look for signs of extraterrestrial life. Some of the conditions in the oceans of these worlds could be similar to habitable conditions in Earth's oceans. For example, similar temperatures and pressures, presence of liquid water and energy from the star, according to astronomer Niku Madhutsudan. He told Science Alert, there are many open questions, but this is only a first guess at this stage. He says the assumption is that if microbial aquatic life can form in these oceans in the same manner as they did on Earth, then some of the biosignatures may be common. You can read more of this story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of your calls for Don Dondarry, the author of Truth, Lies, and ETs, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don, one of the last chapters in the new book is about the ET challenge and how we manage the challenge of ET interference with human life. So let's just sort of walk through what this challenge is all about. What are we up against here?
Well, we're up against a species or more that have technological abilities far greater than our own and have the ability to control us using telepathy. Those are the two things that basically keep us from being equal to these new visitors to and possible inhabitants of Earth. We're in the same position with respect to them as the other species on this planet are with respect to us. We more or less do what we want with them because we can. We have better weapons than the other species do. We control them simply by managing their environment or capturing them and putting them in cages. And that's because we are technologically superior to them. We can out-technology them with guns and traps and bait and what have you. We don't need telepathy to outdo them because we've got the other tools. But the ETs have both superior technology and the ability to control humans by telepathy. And both of those put us on the left foot, so to speak.
Would you add to that the possibility that they're also raising an alien-human hybrid army?
Yes. Not army, but they're raising alien-human hybrids, and those hybrids, which have telepathic abilities, are also part of the picture of a, in this case, new species that might be intended either to replace us or to manage us. We don't know. All of those are speculations. But the fact is, we are without the ability to control our own lives when we are subject to their telepathic control and their technological superiority. Even if they didn't telepathically control us, an ETV could come zooming down over you, lift you involuntarily into the ETV, and then they could do what they want with you. So that's not control. That's sort of the way we treat animals. In my earlier book, I reminded you that we treat bears exactly that way. We fly in a helicopter over some bear territory. We fire a tranquilizing dart into the bear, land the helicopter, put a chip under its skin, do whatever we want with it, and let it go again. Then it's under our control. And we're in the same boat, relatively speaking, with respect to ETs.
Does it further complicate our dire situation that a sizable percentage of people actually believe that ETs are here to save us from ourselves?
Well, first of all, they may be, or some of them may be. It's not that. It's not a question of their motives. It's a question of their abilities. Their motives, or the motives of some of them, may be very good, but they're exercising those motives the same way we exercise control over animals we actually like. And that means that we don't want to kill off all the orangutans or all the buffaloes or all the chimpanzees. We just want to make sure that they live in a way we want them to live. Now, it may be that some ETs are looking after our best interests. We obviously have a lot of problems. We have nuclear weapons. We have no systematic way of regulating ourselves, one country vis-a-vis another, on Earth. So we're faced with multiple problems, which we have to resolve. If we're being helped to resolve those problems by ETs, they're not doing it directly. They're not coming to the UN and saying, here, we need you to do this because if you don't, you're going to ruin yourselves. Instead, they're doing it by insinuating themselves into our life through telepathy, abductions, and possibly the production of hybrids. Those are the challenges. And we have to deal with them. And I think the best way to deal with them to start with is to recognize them. Recognize those challenges exist. Then learn what we can do defensively about them. Thing one is obviously to develop a technology that more or less equals ET technology, which we're, I don't know how far from doing. Thing two is to develop a technology that protects us from telepathy. Now, here's where the joke comes in, because everybody who knows about UFOs and thinks UFO people are crazy thinks about the tinfoil hat, the thing that you put on to keep yourself from being abducted by UFOs. But as I said earlier, the tinfoil hat may not be that far from reality, because some of the control may be done electromagnetically, and one way that's already used to keep EMG radiation out of your head and it's used routinely by people who do work on high-tension lines and things like that, is a hat full of protective shielding, which keeps the radio waves out of your head from frying your brain. And something like that might be used as a protection against deceased telepathy.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The wild card line, Alex is in Rochester, New Hampshire. Alex, welcome to Coast.
Yes, I'm enjoying the show. Thanks for taking my call. I agree with at least 90 to 95% of what the professor is saying. But my question, I have two questions, if I may. I'll keep it brief. The first question, why does Professor Dondarri believe that the technologically superior beings who sometimes abduct humans are likely extraterrestrial in origin? Couldn't they just as likely be from under Mother Earth, like under the ocean or under the mountains or something like that? The second question is, has the professor heard of people who have witnessed a UFO by psychically sensing it before they saw it with their eyes?
Question one, maybe. It may be that some of them have landed here and are sort of hiding themselves under the earth. I don't know the answer to that. Number two, often psychic awareness accompanies a UFO sighting, so they may be simultaneous. And three, I just drove through Rochester the other day. It's a beautiful little town. Hope you enjoyed as much as I enjoyed the visit.
All right. Alex, thank you for that. Lisa is in Madison, New Jersey. Lisa, good morning. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. I was wondering if Don could talk about Ewan Cameron and the horrific MK Ultra Subproject 68 psychiatric experiments that were done on people, the abusive mind clearing.
I guess the connection there being McGill University, but it was done. I think they were performed at Allen Memorial Hospital. I'm not sure if that.
Yes,
that has
so
to
there
do
was
with...
some work done on patients at Allen Memorial Hospital at McGill. I actually was a university administrator at the time, and had to write a report about it. The research was not was supported by the CIA. It was not good for the people who did it, and it was stopped. And that's really all I have to say about it. I'm not hiding anything. That's about all I know, except it came to my attention when I was, as a matter of fact, the associate dean of the graduate faculty of research, and I had to deal with it in part. The dean asked me to write a report on it. I did, and I explained what I knew, which is about what I've just said.
All right, Lisa, thank you for that. Richard is east of the Rockies, Middleton, New York. Richard, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Yes, Don, I admire your thoroughness and scholarly approach to the ET issue. When you were describing the test that you helped develop with Bud Hopkins,
right.
It struck me as being quite similar to the MMPI in its number of items and its binary response. I was just wondering if the MMPI, considering that thousands of them have been given since the 30s, could be used looking back over MMPIs that are on record, or used in any other way to develop an index or a scale to develop susceptibility to being a contactee, or personality research on the personality characteristics of the contactees.
It sounds like you know what you're talking about, and the answer is it's been done. The MMPI has been used in various profiling studies of people who've been abducted or of people who might have been abducted, and it isn't a definitive test. It does show that the people who have been abducted differ on some of the characteristics of the MMPI, but it's not as discriminating as the one that was developed by Davis and Hopkins. And by the way, it was about the same length, as you well know, because I think you must be somebody who gives that test routinely. Anyway, it was used, but the research, it wasn't a discriminative way to separate abductees from other people.
Richard, thank you for the call. Given the nature of this ET challenge, what are your thoughts on attempts to contact ETs, these the CE5s, they call them, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. Is that something that we should be wary about?
I don't know. I really don't. I don't think, well, first of all, ETs contact us involuntarily, frequently. And that's the subject of people, I mean, that's what people are studying when they study abductees. Whether there have been any official efforts to contact ETs of one species or another, I do not know. And I don't know whether it would be a wise idea. I actually hadn't thought about that. I don't know whether it would be a wise idea to start that before we're in a position to be treated as equals or not, honestly.
Excellent point. Joe is in Monterey, California. Joe, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you, Richard. This is a very good show, like all Coast to Coast shows. Professor, I applaud you for the work you're doing and the and maintaining an objective viewpoint, as all good scientists have to do. You are right when you say, I have experiences in this area, so I'll just come off and say that. What my experiences are, I will keep from the public right now. I have met a hybrid, I know a hybrid, and I won't go into the details. And you're right when you say, we know very little. There is a world of information out there. And when you enter that world as an equal to an extraterrestrial, they will treat you as an equal if they're spiritual. And that's the crux of this whole conversation. The evolution of soul is at stake here. And these negative ETs see that as a threat, because as we evolve, we enter into those worlds consciously. And we can be very powerful as a spiritual being with certain gifts. And as telepathy, sometimes having telepathy is more of a problem and can be dangerous, because you are broadcasting what you know, and they hear it, and they watch you. And that's the abduction scenario. They may be looking at what you're going to do in the future. It's all about control. They are criminals. And we consider, like any criminal organization, demonic in essence. This is not my words. This is extraterrestrials' view of their own kind, or shall I say, in that world, in that dimension. As far as dealing with them, technology on their level, not possible. Their minds work differently. Their thought processes and how they process information is much faster. It's a whole other it's a whole other reality that they are, that they have acclimated themselves, and they in and their environment creates their evolution. They are genetically, physically different than us genetically.
And all right, Joe, I gotta leave it there because we're just about out of time. And thank you for the call. Any techniques that can thwart an abduction that you know of, Don?
No, other than the possibility of blocking electromagnetic waves that convey telepathy. But I can't tell you that that works. I have no idea it works. There's a gentleman named Michael Mencken, who won't mind me using his name, I'm sure, who makes protective helmets, basically the real equivalent of the joke tinfoil hat. And he claims, and I think with some evidence, but not scientific in the long sense, that his helmets help people prevent being abducted. That is, on Mencken's word, on the research that I've read of his that he's presented, and it's online. You can look him up, Menkin. And that's the closest I've come to understanding that, other than the fact that other people use electromagnetic hats to protect themselves against radiation when they're out working on high-tension lines, and that's public domain. That's stuff that you can buy on the Internet.
Is it generational? It's many abductees have claimed that it is generational. It happened to their parents. It's happening to them. It'll happen to their children. Any thoughts on that?
I think so, just on the basis of what I've read.
All right. So Truth Lies in ETs, How We Stumbled into the Galaxy. This is forthcoming. Any idea on the ETA for the publication date, Don?
March 2020.
March 2020.
March 2022.
March 2022. Okay. All right.
2022. Yeah, sorry.
All right. And that'll be available Amazon and good bookstores everywhere.
I hope so. That's the plan.
Terrific. And the website, UFOETS.com, UFOETS.com. Don, great pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
It was my pleasure. Thanks. I very much enjoyed your informed and literate discussion. Thank you.
Don Derry, Ph.D. All right. When we come back, the 24th anniversary of the assassination of Princess Diana, Sarah Whalen, waiting in the wings. Back with more Coast to Coast AM.